I've been asked to be chair for myself, so I'm going to introduce myself. My name is Joanne Mouthaan. I work at the Amsterdam Medical Center for the University of Amsterdam. I work at the Center for Anxiety Disorders, the Psychotrauma Research Group, at the Psychiatry Department of the AMC Medical Hospital. And I'm here to share you some of our experiences with you about the Trauma Tips Intervention website. It's a brief web-based early intervention to prevent PTSD in injured trauma patients. And I'd really like to stress that these are the preliminary results. We just finished including all the patients for the RCT, but I really want to show you what we've done with the analysis so far and show you some trends that we can hopefully discuss at the end of the talk. No conflicts of interests. Traumatic injury is very common in Western societies, and in the Netherlands, which is a small country with only 60 million inhabitants, we had nearly 1 million emergency department treatments of traumatic injury over the course of 4 years, which is quite a lot if you think of how little people live in the Netherlands. And more importantly, traumatic injury is also one of the most common causes for psychological trauma. Psychiatric disorders are very prevalent after trauma, also the same for traumatic injury, with 17 to 19% of people developing a post-traumatic stress disorder, 15 to 37% developing some other anxiety disorder, for instance, panic disorder, agoraphobia, specific phobias, and 14 to 17% developing depressive disorder. And most importantly, there's a high comorbidity rate between disorders. So much attention in recent years have been spent on preventing strategies or developing strategies to prevent this long-lasting psychological suffering in after trauma in the form of early interventions. And I'd just like to show you the state of affairs so far in the early intervention research area. Maybe you're all familiar with it, but I'll just go through it very quickly. The most commonly provided prevention strategy after trauma is single-session debriefing. The debriefing protocol has been applied in various manners over the years in terms of the duration of the protocol, the target group, and the content. But they all have the same similarities, namely the early timing after the event. It all included emotional ventilation about details of the event, and providing psychoeducation of what to do with your psychological consequences after trauma. There have been numerous studies on psychological debriefing, and they've all shown that single-session psychological debriefing was not useful in preventing symptoms of PTSD after trauma, and it was even found harmful in certain subgroups of traumatic victims. And the main suggested reason for that is that the emotional ventilation part, so making people relive their experiences, and the single session nature of the intervention, so having people done it only once telling about what they've gone through, really increases levels of distress instead of decreasing PTSD symptoms. So there have been other initiatives in early interventions after trauma, especially for traumatic injury victims. And one of those is offering self-help information to prevent chronic PTSD symptoms. So there were three RCTs who all compared providing self-help brochures or folders on psychological symptoms after traumatic events to groups of traumatic injury victims. They all found that there was no evidence of effectiveness in preventing PTSD. And there were even trends that the victims who received the self-help brochures even did a little worse than the control group who didn't get any of the psychoeducation. In the States, there's another type of early intervention, which was trialed. It's called collaborative care. And collaborative care is a comprehensive treatment delivery model in which patients are assigned a trauma support specialist who monitors their physical and mental health condition and who also is the main contact figure for any specialist attention that they can get, be it medical or psychiatric. They compared a group with the collaborative care approach with the usual care group, which mainly consisted of getting community referrals from mental health treatment. And they found that the collaborative care group showed significantly less alcohol abuse after 12 months, but there were no differences in PTSD scores. However, the PTSD symptoms in the usual care group worsened over the course of 12 months, whereas the PTSD symptoms in the collaborative care approach maintained the same rate. So there could be a possible preventative effect of collaborative care, but the study design did not allow for any subgroup analyses on that. Lastly, I want to show you psychological first aid. It's newly developed and it really complies with current guidelines on acute care after trauma. It's a really a supportive, empathic listening approach which focuses on practical assistance such as ensuring safety, helping people meet their basic needs after trauma. So it really looks like a promising early intervention strategy, but no study has been done to test its effectiveness yet. The one group of psychotherapeutic intervention, early interventions, that have consistently been shown to be effective is CBT. Well, we heard a lot about CBT in the last few days, so I'm not going into all of the specifics, but for traumatic injury patients, it was typically a 4-to-5 session protocol offered within 2 to 6 weeks after trauma, so fairly early. And it has been found effective in motor vehicle accident and industrial accident survivors, survivors of non-sexual assault, injured patients of an emergency department. So various group of traumatic injury patients. Mostly CBT was offered in the 4-to-5 sessions, so multiple sessions of CBT. But two studies have shown that CBT techniques can also be usefully and effectively applied in only as little as 1 or 2 sessions. So that really holds promise for brief early interventions. And whereas the CBT treatments that are on this sheet have focused on a selected group of highly symptomatic traumatic injury patients, they have not yet been studied for its effectiveness in a non-selected trauma population. So that will be interesting as well. So following traumatic events, there are many practical difficulties that clinicians experience in care delivery to the people that really need it. You can think about the hectic nature of traumatic events itself, which make it really time-consuming to identify those people who need help and really costly as well. And especially if you're aiming at prevention of PTSD. The DSM-4 says symptoms have to be present for 4 weeks, so you only have really have 1 month of time in which you can offer people interventions to prevent the development of PTSD. So the advantages of the internet are noticeably the broad dissemination because you can reach people easier and faster. It's really interactive, so it allows for tailoring of the interventions, all things that we heard throughout the conference, of course. Patients can use it anytime and anywhere they want, and more importantly, it has been shown in many meta-analyses and reviews that internet treatments can be successfully applied to patients for a number of XS1 disorders, so PTSD is no exception on that. As for prevention on the internet, I want to show you or quickly browse through a few interventions that have been implemented earlier and successfully implemented. For instance, the Catch It program, which was which the author spoke about this earlier this day. It showed a significant decline in depressive symptoms in adolescents with depressive symptoms and problems over the course of 12 weeks and even showed that it was successful over the course of a year. Results that still have to be published, though. There was another internet-based program preventing stress and mood problems in the workplace. It also showed that it was significant in reducing stress and binge drinking at 3 months. It also helped people gain more knowledge on what depression and anxiety really are, and also helped them gain a more positive attitude on help seeking. Another 4-week self-help program was found to be effective. This had supporting email feedback from therapists to prevent depression and anxiety and distress. And lastly, I want to show you my student body stress, which was an enhancing stress management skills program that also promoted health behaviors in college students. They found no effects on the primary outcomes, but they did find that the intervention group students had more weekly physical activity after the program. They used more specific stress management skills that they learned online, and they had fewer anxiety and family problems. If we look specifically to trauma survivors, the internet interventions distributed so far are predominantly curative, but they have found to be effective. For instance, I'm not going into these either in length, but Interpy is a well-known writing therapy. 5 weeks with 10 45-minute writing sessions. They get therapist feedback for over 7 times during the program. It was found to be effective in 3 RCTs. There's an 8-week self-help program for mild PTSD symptoms with no therapist feedback, which was also found to be effective for symptoms of PTSD. Family problem-solving therapy online that reduced anxiety and depression in parents of a child with traumatic brain injury in the year before starting treatment also had significant effects. And the De-Stress Program by Brad Litz is an 8-week therapist-assisted stress inoculation training program for trauma survivors. He just recently published new results, which pointed to the effectiveness of the program. As for preventive internet interventions for trauma survivors, we only know one, which was issued among 285 New York City area residents with for problems regarding the 9/11 attacks. It was really a feasibility study that they did to see whether the program, which had 14 modules varying from depression to worry to panic to PTSD, were feasible for implementing in a post-disaster situation, and it found it to be feasible, but we still wait to see what it does in a real prevention situation. So now I come to the Trauma Tips intervention, which is our intervention. And Trauma Tips stands for the Incidence of Post-Trauma Psychopathology Study, so it really aims at trauma-related problems, psychological problems for traumatic injury survivors. Our main aim was to reduce initial distress. We really want to develop something new in early intervention field to prevent PTSD among injured trauma patients. And it's important to bear in mind that we don't aim our intervention at a selected group of highly symptomatic traumatic injury patients. It's really aimed at the whole population. So in the words of Helen Christensen this morning, it's a selected preventative measure, not an indicated preventative measure. We expect it to decrease acute distress levels on the short term in order to prevent PTSD on the long term. So really aim at relaxation and distraction and healthy coping behavior. The reasons for choosing multimedia or the internet is that it really places little to no emphasis on expressing emotions. And that was one of the things that mainly came out of the whole debriefing argument, is that if you're only going to see people once for an early intervention, it's really not good to let them talk about what happened to them into detail, because you're not able to just monitor their complaints and their problems and their symptoms as you would in a face-to-face therapy with multiple sessions. So it's good to be on the other side of the spectrum and have your emphasis on relaxation and just getting the acute distress levels down instead of raising them. One of the other reasons is that the participation is voluntary. That's also one of the perks, I think, of the internet. You really get people who want to do something. Otherwise, they won't invest their time into it. It's really also the patient that takes the initiative, which also gives them a sense of controlling it. Of course, the easy access at home, and for these patients also in hospital, and they can do it as many times as they want to. This is the structure. I'm going to go through it really fast because I really want to show you the intervention. We start, of course, with an introduction and login. Next, people get an online assessment of anxiety and arousal symptoms. The next part is called trauma and experiences. And first, they see a video of a trauma unit professional who explains the steps in the program to them, and it's really based on reassurance and providing some motivation for doing the rest of the program. Next, people can choose and click on the videos of three patients. They're all modeled after the distribution of age, gender, and traumatic event that we have in our trauma registry records. And more importantly, in the videos, you see the patients talking about how they've coped with the aftermath of trauma. So they don't place any emphasis on the traumatic event itself. You don't get any details. They don't really go into detail about what kinds of symptoms they have, but mainly what they did to overcome those symptoms. And the last part is a short textual summary of all the coping information from the videos. Then we go to exercises, and we present two auditory relaxation exercises. One is aimed at muscle relaxation, the other is aimed at imagining a safe and secure place and retraining breathing. Then a post-test of anxiety and arousal, and at the end page, people can leave their questions or remarks for us. They can also contact us if they need assistance with, for instance, the program, but also more mental health assistance. They can find information on where to seek help if they need it. And there's also a web form where they can share experiences with their peers. So this is what the program looks like. We've seen more or prettier programs, I must say, in the last days. But our aim with the program was that it should be simple. Everybody should be able to understand it. There's a navigational bar on top with the steps that I just showed you to let people see where they are in the program at all times. Here on this page, we explain the aim of the intervention, of course, and give some instructions on how to operate it, but it's really just click on the button next and you get to the next session. It's that easy. So people are provided with a login name, and if they lose it, they can get an email. This is the second step in the intervention, or the first real step, which are the questions. We have a visual analog scale, which represents a thermometer, if you will, of anxiety symptoms and arousal symptoms. We also wanted this to be as straightforward and easy, as simple as possible. So 0 represents no anxiety, no distress, no arousal, and 100 is the worst imaginable state. So somewhere along the line, patients can just decide where they are. Here we go to the video of the trauma unit professional. This is the head of the trauma unit department, and he explains how things work in the program and explains that there are ways of people coping with whatever physical or psychological consequences they may have after the program. More importantly, in all the videos and the exercises, patients have the possibility to stop them, to rewind them if they missed something in it, fast-forward them or look at them several times, but they also have the possibility of skipping it altogether. And for the RCT reasons, we, of course, monitor everything they do in the program, so if they stop the video after 1 minute, we see that they only saw the video for 1 minute. And if they don't look at the video at all, that will be known to us as well. Next, people move to the experiences bit, and here we have the videos of the three patients. They are actors, but the scripts for the patients are real patient stories. and the distribution, as I said, of age, gender, and traumatic event are similar to, or the events that we see most in our hospital. So we have Pete, who's 51 years old, and who fell off a roof during work, so an industrial accident. We have Mike, who's 31 years old, who got into a car accident on the freeway. And we have Esther, of 35 years old, who was physically assaulted and robbed of her purse on her way home from work. And again, patients are free to choose any of the videos. They can look at the videos multiple times if they wish, and they can skip them altogether. These are just five coping tips that are presented in the videos of the patients, and they're in all the videos. So even though the patients tell about his or her own story of what happened to them and how they've coped, it's all based on the same principles. So no matter what video you saw, you will always recognize these tips. These are the exercises. You can see body scan is the muscle relaxation, the veilige plek, it's not Dutch of course, it's a safe place. And again, free to choose any of them, and none of them, or skip through them. The post-assessment questions, again the same scales. And the end page, and they can click on links to leave messages, to enter a web forum, you suggest some questions. Contact the team for extra support or help, and also a web forum where they can leave their own story or respond to any of the stories that are there, also already there by other patients. So now I want to show you some of the elements, or explain some of the elements to you in the intervention, and one of the most important elements of many mental health interventions is information. We already had a few talks on psychoeducation and providing information over the internet. And what I wanted to let you know is what I discussed earlier. There's really no evidence for psychoeducation alone as a preventative measure for PTSD. But there have been studies, among which in emergency department patients with panic attacks, that if you couple psychoeducation with exposure instructions, that it could be effective in decreasing symptoms. So that's good to bear in mind. And in a recent review of the influence of psychoeducation on traumatic events or consequences of traumatic events, it was also suggested that maybe the type of information provided in the intervention so far wasn't optimal. The focus should really be on recovery and resilience, and not on symptoms and disorders. So you don't want to talk people into their symptoms, but you want them to get rid of them by making them feel good about what they already do. So in our intervention, we give information throughout the program. First and foremost, in the video of the chief trauma surgeon, who introduces patients to the program, lets them know that there are things that they can do to increase their healthy behaviors and getting back on track and promoting their recovery. So it's really based on reassurance and picking up normal routine. In the videos of the three patients, the aim is of transferring knowledge on successful coping strategies and promoting recovery, and also picking up normal routine again. The same for the textual summary of the tips. And of course, we present information on where to seek help if they really need it. The second element is modeling. And modeling has been used to facilitate behavior change and attitude change. It stems from social learning theory, of course. And it's been applied, and it's still being applied, in many educational programs and organizational programs to accomplish learning and change in attitudes and behavior. And it has been successfully applied also as written modeling. So people just reading anecdotes from other people saying how they've changed their life also helps them change their lives. And also video modeling is used very frequently to let people see that other behavior is also possible. If we look at trauma-related early interventions, we see that the technique of modeling was also used in a video early intervention. It was a 17-minute video aimed for rape victims who would just undergo their forensic medical exam. It was aimed at reducing initial distress, levels and also at reducing anxiety about the forensic medical exam. And it showed a model of a patient undergoing the exam and conveying information on common physical and psychological responses to rape and exposure instructions. And it showed to be effective in women with a prior rape history, but it had little to no effect on women who didn't have a prior rape history. So it looked like the women who already went through the whole experience of rape and forensic medical exam did know how to better pick up the information from the video than the women who didn't. In our intervention, of course, the modeling is done by the three patients. As I said, we distribute it according to what we find in the trauma registry records. And even though they all tell their own story, they have the commonalities of providing information on successful coping and engaging in activities to reduce avoidance behavior, so they're also visually shown by the models. And the emphasis is really on re-entry in normal routine and constructive behavior. Exposure is something that we heard of also today. In treatment, mostly used is imaginal exposure, mainly for the extinction of conditioned responses, aversive reactions to the details of the event. And it's normally repeated over multiple sessions to ensure maximal extinction. As I said before, in psychological debriefing, it's suggested that the part of the imaginal exposure in one session only leads to an increase in levels. So its current guidelines therefore really warn against early interventions that address that kind of trauma focus in their programs. But another type of exposure is in vivo exposure, in which the patient applies him or herself to self-directed exposure exercises to a feared stimulus or, for example, a situation or an activity. In PTSD treatments, often intermixed with imaginal exposure, but it's also been found to be effective as a single session treatment in patients with chronic PTSD following an earthquake. So we really try to give in vivo exposure tips as narrative information from the patient models, explaining how they gradually did the activities again that they normally already did and how they encountered situations that initially provoked anxiety. They're also visually shown, as I said before, and it's really the aim to stimulate patients to go back and live their lives again and to prevent any avoidance behavior. Social support is something that David Spiegel already mentioned earlier. It's been consistently found to have an important and positive impact on mental health. Lack of social support is a strong predictor for chronic PTSD. Positive social support enhances psychosocial adjustment after trauma, and stimulating the use of a social network has been regarded as a beneficial coping strategy, also used in other early interventions. So we use it as an integral part of our intervention, not only as anecdotal information by the patients, but also in the form of coping tips and the forum at the end of the website. And lastly, the relaxation training part in our intervention. Relaxation training has been used as a separate treatment, but mostly as part of CBT, and it was aimed at reducing symptom levels and regaining a sense of control again over symptom levels and health in general. And is not regarded as an effective standalone treatment, but it's usually provided within a larger framework of CBT. So we present two audio clips of approximately 7 minutes duration with instructions for stress management techniques. And also, I already explained that one is about muscle relaxation and the other about imagining a safe place and to decrease acute distress levels. So what I really want to do now is show you a clip, one of the patient videos, because it really shows what I what the intervention is about. So it shows you all the elements that I just talked about, from information to relaxation.
plaats van ver op weg naar huis. En toen ben ik aangevallen door twee jongens. Die hebben me beroofd in de tas. Ja, het ging allemaal zo ontzettend snel en plotseling. Zo'n onwerkelijke situatie dat ik me van heel veel dingen niet zoveel meer kan herinneren. Ik kan me bijvoorbeeld niet meer herinneren de ambulance rit, waar ik op de traumahulp ben geweest. Maar ik heb een klap tegen mijn hoofd gehad, dus het moest gehecht worden. Dus ik ben een nacht ter observatie in het ziekenhuis gebleven. De volgende dag kom ik eigenlijk weer naar huis. Ik was echt heel erg geschrokken. En ja, wat je dan krijgt is dat iedere keer als je eraan terugdenkt, ja, dan raak je ook ontzettend angstig weer. En dan, ja, dan heb je ook heel veel moeite om zeg maar weer de straat op te gaan. Nou ja, dus ik heb eigenlijk een beroep gedaan met mijn buurvrouw. En gevraagd van, goh, als je nou boodschappen gaat doen, mag ik dan mee? Weet je, moet toch gewoon weer al die dingen gaan doen. Nou, dat heeft me wel heel erg geholpen. En ik merkte ook dat, zeg maar, vrienden mij ook wel heel erg ondersteund hebben.
Esther?
Hey! Heel simpel. Ik kon mijn vriendin altijd bellen. Om haar te luchten als ik angstig was. Maar ook als ik even geen zin had om erover te praten. Gewoon over leuke dingen hebben, zodat je gewoon afgeleid wordt. Ik heb heel veel hulp gehad aan vrienden, maar ook zeg maar aan mijn werk. Want ik ben toch wel weer vrij snel begonnen met werk. Gelukkig begrepen ze daar, dus ik kon rustig aan doen. En dat zorgt ook zeg maar voor afleiding. Want je bent weer aan de mensen, je bent weer aan het werk. Dus dan hoef je gewoon niet te denken aan wat er al is gebeurd. Alleen s'avonds, ja, dan zit je hier en dan ga je slapen en dan word je toch weer, dan ga je weer aan denken. Dus toen ben ik begonnen met ontspanningsoefeningen. En dat heeft me ook heel erg geholpen. Dus eigenlijk de belangrijkste elementen, nou, veel onder mensen afleiding zoeken. En s'avonds probeer je te ontspannen voordat je gaat slapen. Ik heb wel het gevoel dat ik mijn oude patroon weer heb opgepakt. In het begin durfde ik ook nog niet te sporten. Ik schorst, dus ik dacht van ja, het kan niet met die hechtingen. Ik ben toch gaan proberen. Nou, dat is allemaal goed gegaan. Het gaat eigenlijk wel goed.
So as you can see, it's really positive.
Was the script exactly as the original victim said it? Was it verbatim, or was it kind of reworked to put all the elements and make it succinct?
It was kind of reworked to make it a shorter version, and it was elements from different patients as well. And of course, we also included some of the tips that evidence that are evidence based that we find really helpful in treating patients and helping patients overcome their traumatic aftermath. Don't know what I did. Oh, here it is. Now, for the design of the randomized controlled trial, patients come into our trauma center, and they're contacted by a member of the research team within 3 days, mainly. We don't chase after the ambulance, because we find people needing other services, of course, in the first few hours. And it makes much more sense to contact them after 24 hours. When they do agree to participate, it was often difficult to randomize them into the trial because they, due to their injuries or rehabilitation programs, most of them couldn't be randomized within the first month after their traumatic incident. And that was really the main inclusion criteria for us, because we wanted to aim at prevention and not treatment. And if you wait after 1 month post-trauma, patients can already have developed PTSD. So patients who could be randomized within the first month after trauma, they both get, of course, a baseline clinical interview, and they also perform several self-report measures for PTSD, anxiety, and depression. Patients in the intervention condition are provided with a login and log on, and they can log on as many times as they wish. And then after 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, and 12 months, get their follow-up clinical assessments. We consecutively included patients from September 2007 until recently and February. And we included them if they were adults, if they had intentional or unintentional injuries and a trauma mechanism according to the A1 criterion of PTC in the DSM-4, so a proper traumatic event, not a life event. Excluded when it were self-inflicted injuries, when they're non-Dutch speaking or living abroad, had psychotic symptoms of disorder, high suicide risk, any organic disorders such as dementia or other cognitive impairments that would not enable them to do the intervention. And of course they gave written and oral informed consent. These are the assessments that that I like to discuss. We did much more assessments also on quality of life and cost effectiveness, but I can't go into detail for those. Self-report measures that I'll be presenting are the Impact of Event Scale Revised, the Hospital Anxiety and Depression Scale for Anxiety and Depression, and the Clinical Diagnosis of the CAPS and the MINI, which is an international neuropsychiatric interview for XS1 disorders. For the analysis, we did repeated measurements with a linear mixed model. We looked at the effects of group time and the group by time interaction effects, and we controlled for baseline et al. Analyses, and we did intent to treat. So we included from 1,810 patients who went through the hospital system, adult patients, of which we had to exclude 319, mainly because they were non-Dutch speaking or living abroad, or were deceased, had suicide attempts or suicide risks, were cognitively impaired or psychotic, and there were a number of other reasons for excluding patients. About 400 didn't respond to any of our telephone attempts to get them to approach them for the study or written attempts, and we did a lot. And there were also 58 with incorrect addresses, which is strange because they come into the hospital and are supposed to give their correct address. And 138 we were otherwise unable to approach because they left the hospital before we could get in touch with them, went to other hospitals or rehabilitation institutions, just lost to follow up. 350 refused, but 535 did agree to participate. 235 could not be randomized within a one-month period, so leaving us with a neat 300, the amount that we needed for adequate power. I briefly looked at the dropout, and we only have 10 patients dropping out after randomization, of which 3 in the intervention condition and 7 in the control condition. And even though it's just 10 out of 300, they did differ from the patients who didn't drop out. So they had significantly lower injury severity scores, so they were less severely injured, but they had higher baseline scores for depression, anxiety, and PTSD, and also peritraumatic reactions. So it is a specific sample, I think, within the whole subgroup. These are some of the demographics. No significant differences between the groups. Mean age of 44, 60% male sex, which is also normal for the traumatic injury population. 3/4 were married and cohabiting. A slightly higher educational level than the normal population in the Netherlands, and mostly from the Hollands originally. The only significant difference between the groups in trauma-related characteristics was that the intervention group was significantly more severely injured, but they didn't have any significant differences in the level of consciousness when they got to the hospital, so it wasn't necessarily due to brain injury or anything. This is a traumatic event. As you can see, mostly are traffic-related accidents, like motor vehicle accidents or bicycle accidents, which occur quite common in the Netherlands. 15% had a fall from a height, mostly down the stairs in their own home. 11% was work-related, and the categories of physical abuse, airplane crash, domestic or recreational accidents were all less than 3%. These are the login characteristics. Mean number of logins on the website is 1.7, so that's not very much, but we do have a large standard deviation. There's 22.5% who didn't log on at all. So that's comparable to the dropout in treatment studies, which also get 20 to 25% of patients not completing any treatment at all. So I think for internet interventions, it's really not that different. And the patients had a mean number of minutes of 20 to complete the program. So for the patients who did log on and did complete the program, they had a reduction in acute arousal and anxiety for 3 points for anxiety and 5 points for arousal. So this shows that the program does reduce symptoms a bit and doesn't increase them. These are the baseline differences between the groups. They do have significant differences in baseline total PTC symptoms and intrusion symptoms. The rest of the, for avoidance and hyperarousal, there weren't any significant differences, but the control group does seem to do a little worse at baseline. For anxiety and depression scores, and even for anxiety and depression diagnosis, there were no significant differences. These are the diagnoses of the psychopathology, of the CAPS and the MINI. No significant differences here either. You do see, I thought it was pretty salient, that in the intervention condition, the patients at 1 month, 9% has a PTSD diagnosis and 5% has PTSD diagnosis at 3 months. And for the control condition, it seems to rise a bit. But due to small numbers, it wasn't found to be any significance between that. These are the main outcomes. So this is the mixed model. We only find a time effect for hyperarousal and a group effect for depression. So we don't find any group by time interaction effects. And I do want to show you some of the results in a graphical sense, because they all show the same image. And this is the trend that I talked about in the beginning. The intervention condition seems to have a slightly steeper decline in symptoms than the control condition. But again, the model didn't find any significant results, so we do have to be careful about that. But it's the same image for all the assessments, as you can see. So in conclusion, there were no harmful effects found. The intervention group scores lower than the control group on all measures of PTSD, anxiety, and depression. But still, these are trends, because no significant interaction effects were found in the model. We do need to enter all the data. We do need to do the final analyses. But still, I don't want to be too forward in saying that this is a really effective program, because we really the results don't show that. But it does show that offering such a brief web-based intervention to a recently traumatized and injured trauma sample is feasible, and it's also well-tolerated. So for future directions, we really would like to see what the final group, of course, will show us. Maybe some of the effects will turn to be effective or significant. But we also want to look at more subgroup effects. So, for instance, what the reduction in acute arousal and anxiety will do with the effectiveness of the intervention, certain login behaviors. You can imagine that people who've only logged in once could be quite different from people who logged in twice or more. And also to see whether injury characteristics could affect the effectiveness of the intervention. So lastly, these are the many, many people who work with me on the project, especially the interviewers and students who collect all the data and answer them. So many thanks to them. And I'm ready for questions now. So thank you. Yeah.
Well, first, great work. It's a great initiative to develop a tool that could be available almost on the spot.
Yeah.
You know, and we're coming out of another classroom, and with your instinct or your research, would you believe? And what I saw in your video is like a soft debriefing, or a positive outcome of the person getting better.
Mm-hmm.
Is that is that the general approach you have with your videos?
Yeah.
Okay.
It is. It's really on promoting healthy behaviors.
Okay.
Letting people know that they're it's not. The focus is really not on the symptoms. It's about getting better. And it's showing people doing better if they apply themselves to, for instance, simple things that people normally would do. Just lean on their friends, for instance, or their neighbor when they're going grocery shopping, or trying to find some distraction if they find that their thoughts are too heavy for them. So that is really what we try to teach people. Yeah.
And would you believe that with a soft approach like that, you would give it away as soon as possible after the trauma? Or you would think that this type of, I would say, coaching? I saw it as like optimistic coaching.
Yeah, you can call it optimistic coaching, I think,
Would you give it like a week after, so that the person can digest, or you would give it on the spot?
Now, I think because we did the baseline assessments approximately at 1 week, 1 to 2 weeks post-trauma, and that's when the patients got their login.
Okay.
So they had it in the second half of the first month after trauma, and I think that's the period of time that they're ready for it. Beforehand, they're much too worried about their hospital stay, for instance, and when they get back from the hospital, just they mostly have a lot of pain issues and doctor's appointments and getting in touch with work again. And when those first things have settled, you know, then they have room in their head to look at recovery. Yeah.
I was shocked a little bit when you told us that for a woman that lived rape for the first time, there was like no effect on getting down to the idea of or reducing the anxiety related to getting a medical exam.
Yeah.
And there was some significant effect for the woman that did it for the second
time. Yeah.
Could you explain that?
That's really not my study, but no.
I've worked with Heidi Rosenberg.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, please do.
I can tell you a little bit more, and actually, it might actually potentially give you some ideas about what to do to get a bigger effect size.
Okay.
To get a bit bigger, because Heidi's videos, you have a lot of the same components as the Heidi Rosenberg's videos, but hers also involves another component, which involves talking a little bit more about risk factors for future problems. So the individual talking, it actually is broken into two parts. The first part is actually presented to victims in the emergency room.
Okay.
And it kind of outlines basically showing the individual what they're going to go through. As kind of, because one of the things that often occurs is that individuals aren't well explained what the process is.
Like a realistic.
Yes, like almost like a consent form, and this is what a medical exam looks like.
Okay.
These are the components, because often the emergency room staff,
they
don't have the time to fully explain and what happens. And then the second part is much more like this video is, which kind of explains, you know, that these are the symptoms I experienced. These are the things I did to better manage and cope with these symptoms. But it also has another level to it, which is that these are the things that when we start, the common reactions, and these are the common reactions that indicate I need help. So that's one thing that this video didn't have, which was this is the point when I need more clinical attention and that this video isn't adequate for me.
Okay.
And one of the things that a lot of work with Heidi on that video and some of the other projects we've developed similar videos for, that's been a big focus on us, is what to do with the individuals who need more than this.
Yeah.
How to provide them that extra level of help. And a lot of them are reporting that kind of direction towards other resources as being a big component of helping them more. Does that help a little bit?
Perfect. Yeah. You just made it so clear to me that.
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
And I also think, because rape is such a different experience than a traumatic injury, that you really should have a different focus too in your intervention research. So traumatic injuries are also much more stigma-free. They're so common. Everybody's in an accident at some point in their lives, that And that's a main component that rape still has with it. So, yeah.
I was wondering about the statistical analyses that you showed comparing the control group from the treatment group. If those were only people who completed the treatment,
mm-hmm.
yes?
No, we did intent to treat. So
okay.
We did all, regardless of dropout or people that didn't log on, it's just the intervention group versus the control group.
Okay.
Yeah, everybody.
Okay. If you were to take only the intervention group, everybody, and look at the components. So do the number of times they logged in make a difference to their outcomes? What kind of aspects of the use of the program
mm-hmm.
predict outcomes? Have you done that?
No, not yet, because we don't have all the data entered. So we still are missing some of the 1 month and the 3 month follow-up data. We really tried to get all the data entered before this conference, but didn't really work, but those are the things that we really would like to look at next.
Even if you controlled for the severity of the injury,
We just controlled for baseline symptoms because those are the main analyses, and because we still were missing some of the data, I really didn't want to control for too much yet. Because it felt like I was fishing for some results, even though I don't even have all my measurements yet. So, yeah.
But I think the two groups vary
at baseline
by the severity.
Yeah.
Because there might even be an interaction where, because very often you find that, you know, when the trauma is greater or when the injury is greater, that you have the greatest potential for change. So there could be an interaction between either the severity of the baseline symptoms or the severity of the trauma or the injury.
That would be really good to look at, yes. Because you do see a baseline difference, as you said, in injury severity between the groups, but also in the total number of PTSD symptoms and especially the intrusion component of PTSD symptoms. And intrusion is something that's really intertwined with the injury severity. So people who are more severely injured tend to have less intrusion symptoms because they can remember less. If you're more severely injured, means you're probably had a bigger hit on your body, which causes you to have some kind of amnesia and don't have the same level of detailing of the event in your memory as you would if you were less injured. So that could be a really interesting interaction effect. Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
Follow-up is after 3 months, if I understood.
Yes, 3 months, 6 months, 12 months. Yeah.
So you will go to do in three further months.
Because
I would a little bit contradict to what the lady before me said. I think after, in the first month, it's too early to already screen and say, hey, you have a high level of pathology, you should see a specialist. I think this shouldn't be done because the individual level of people, the quantitativity of pathology is so different from individual to individual. And I saw hundreds of people where we're very close. I would say we have to go to a ward, but like 2-3 days later, they were totally normal. So in the first month, I would not give any recommendation to see the specialist myself.
Yeah.
Well, to clarify, ours was more like suicidality, for instance, in which all cases you would recommend
to
go forward, or complete isolation and unable to, like, they were more of those extreme cases to try to address those. I would otherwise concur with you.
Yeah.
I was wondering about if you measured dissociation and did you address it in the program, how to deal with it, or did you explain what it is?
We measured dissociation. We had the PDI and the PDAQ as baseline measurements, but we didn't address it in the intervention. We didn't, no. Okay, thank you very much.